Sammasambuddhassa Namo tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Namo tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Buddhaṃ Dhammaṃ Sanghaṃ Namassāmi. Okay, so today's sutta has been suggested by one of the people here, one of the students. And the reason why we read out these suttas and ask people to suggest them, there's a whole range of different teachings in these sutras, these discourses from the Buddha. Some are very profound, some are medium profound, some are not so profound, but it gives you the whole range of teachings. And this particular pair of suttas today, it is using metaphors from the life at the time of the Buddha, where in the agrarian societies of the time, many people would make their living not just from farming but from rearing cows, mainly for their milk. And because of that, many people would be very familiar with just the ways for looking after cows and also from other associated practices. And so here you see the Buddha using a contemporary knowledge of the time and adapting it to the practice, especially for a monk, but also relating to your practices for a person who's treading in the path of the Buddha, practicing the Dharma towards enlightenment. So these are two analogies. The first about a person how to look after a cow, and the second about taking cows across a stream. So we can start now with the first, the greater discourse on the cow herd. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jeta's Grove and Artapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied, "the Blessed One said this, Monks, when a cow herd possesses 11 factors, he is incapable of keeping and rearing a herd of cattle. What 11? Here a cow herd has no knowledge of form. He is unskilled in characteristics. 3. He fails to pick out flies' eggs. He fails to dress wounds. 5. He fails to smoke out the sheds. 6. He does not know the watering places. He does not know what it is to have drunk. 8. He does not know the road. He is unskilled in pastures. 10. He milks dry. And lastly, he shows no extra veneration to those bulls who are fathers and leaders of the herd. When a cow herd possesses these 11 factors, he is incapable of keeping and rearing a herd of cattle." Now, when we read that, there's many other those things don't make much sense to us because we've never reared a cow before. But obviously, some things do make sense to us about not milking a cow too dry, and that's being skilled in pastures and knowing the watering places. This is quite obvious to us. Those things which aren't obvious, we can just like assume that they have some very important meaning to people who have ever reared cows. Is there anyone here who's ever reared cows, grown up on a farm? Okay, so all city slickers, as they used to say. But the Buddha is using this as a metaphor. So too, monks, when a monk possesses 11 qualities, he is incapable of growth, increase and fulfillment in this Dharma and discipline. Incapable of growth and fulfillment. What 11? Here a monk has no knowledge of form. We'll see what that means in a minute. 2. He's unskilled in characteristics. 3. He fails to pick out flies' eggs. 4. He fails to dress wounds. 5. He fails to smoke out the sheds. 6. He does not know the watering places. 7. He does not know what it is to have drunk. He does not know the road. 9. He is unskilled in pastures. 10. He milks dry. And 11. He shows no extra veneration to those elder monks of long standing who have long gone forth, who are fathers and leaders of the Sangha. So he's comparing the monks to cows in the end here. But not just the monks, but many other things here. And so there he has made a statement, and now he's going to bring out the meaning of this metaphor. How has a monk no knowledge of form? What does that mean? Obviously, I think for a cowherd, I understand that as, you know, know the sort of the big cows, the small cows, the brown cows, and everything else. Knows which ones are which. What is the knowledge of form here meant by the Buddha? He said, here a monk does not understand as it actually is, that all material form of whatever kind consists of just four great elements, and the material form derived from the four great elements. That is how a bhikkhu has no knowledge of form. Now, many of you will know that the ancient times, the four elements of earth, air, fire, and water was a way of analyzing the constituents of the material world. Now, what form means here means like material stuff, if you like. And the point being here that even though, as you know, that I used to be a physicist before, the four elements have long been superseded by a much more accurate, and you may even say meaningful, dissection of the nature of matter. But nevertheless, the point is that whether it's the four great elements or dividing a matter into the various elements and the subatomic particles which make up those elements, the point being that when you dissect matter, you can find that that's all it really is. It's just like the four elements brought together. Or it is just chemical elements in an arrangement together, or subatomic particles in an arrangement together. But when actually you think of something like that, then it of course takes away your attachment to these things. When you look upon your car as just a bit of metal, that's all it is, coming together, some metal, some rubber, some plastic, all coming together in a certain way. And it's just not so important as this beautiful, wonderful car of yours. And when you actually dissect things and see them in their constituent parts, it brings up a sense of seeing things as they truly are, a sense of understanding their true nature, and then a sense of detachment from these things. And especially as a practitioner of the Dhamma, someone who wants to make progress, you look at your body in that way. It's just a bunch of elements, that's all. And that's all you really are. So next time you say, you know, good morning to your wife, you say, good morning, bunch of elements. The next time you say hello to your husband, you say, hello, you know, four elements. And that's all it is. Or you can split up into five khandhas, or, you know, the other elements of nature. Because that way that you stop thinking about this body as something old or young, beautiful or ugly, Australian or Aboriginal or whatever, it's just elements, that's all. So that gives a sense of taking away the racism, the genderism, and the attachments to our bodies. That's when you have the knowledge of material, of form. Then you can have growth in the Dhamma. Any questions about that? Please, with comments, please bring them up. Okay, next one. How is a monk unskilled in characteristics? Here, a monk does not understand, as it actually is thus. A fool is characterized by his actions. A wise man is characterized by his actions. That is how a monk is unskilled in characteristics. It's obviously how you know a good cow from a bad cow. Not because the cow looks nice, or he goes around with a big mark on him saying, I am a good cow, but by the actions. And of course, that this is also important for growth, especially for those of you who want to listen to a teacher, because in the modern spiritual marketplace, there's many, many people can go up and say that I'm enlightened, that I've got the truth, that the truth has been revealed to me by some higher power, that, you know, I am the greatest meditation teacher, blah, blah, blah. The point is that one should actually look at the person, not through their words, but through their actions. A fool is characterized by his actions or her actions. A wise man is characterized by his or her actions. This is how a monk becomes skilled in characteristics, by knowing that. So especially, one doesn't just get lost in the surface characteristics of a person, just because they may be wealthy, just because they may have a lot of disciples, just because they may appear just very inspiring, and they may give the most wonderful talks. It's by their actions which are most important. So it's one thing to be able to give a talk, it's another thing to be able to live it. That's why always look for their actions. And there's, I was going to say, any young people here, that if you're looking for a partner in life, you don't look for a partner because they look good, or because they're wealthy, or because they say nice things just in your company. By their actions, make sure they're a virtuous person. And that also goes to our leaders, our politicians. Not just what they say, not just what they promise, but know them by their actions. So a fool is characterized by their actions. And a wise person is characterized by their actions. So please know how to distinguish the wise from the fools. Make sense? And then there'll be growth for you in the Dhamma. You won't be following blind leads. Any questions on that one? Yes? Oh, yes. Are you wise? I say, oh yeah, I'm wise, I know the Dhamma, I can actually teach all this, I know the Eightfold Path, I can recite that to you. But that's not being wise. Because sometimes there's some university professors who can write much more detailed analysis of Buddhism than I could ever do. But are they wise? Or are they just knowledgeable? So it's by their actions that's most important. That's how you know a fool from a wise person. Which is why actually it's fascinating when the Buddha was talking to his monks. When you seek for a teacher, you shouldn't just go up to a monk, a senior monk, because they've got a good reputation, and just go and say, please be my teacher. They say you go to the monastery and stay there for a long while and check them out first of all. Sneak up on them. Find out what they're doing when no one's looking. Then you'll be able to find out who they are. Because it's one thing to be able to look good in public. But when you're not in public, when you're in your room or when you're in your cave, what do you do then? And that's actually when you find out, you know, who's really practicing and who's not. By their actions. And also you find out about yourself. Actually, what are you practicing? How are you acting? And in particular, in times of, say, sickness or stress, when life is very difficult, that's when you find out what a wise person is. When things start to go wrong, do you go wrong as well with the things? Or it's only the things out there going wrong, but you always go right? That's a wise person. Is that what you meant, John? Yourself, yes. Next one. This is the third. How does a monk fail to pick out the fly's eggs? This is obviously quite clear, because at least in Australia we know that sheep get fly blown very easily. And obviously those blowflies, which you all know in the summertime here, they lay their eggs usually in the rump of these sheep where there's some flesh showing and there's usually some nutriment there. And it's very terrible actually to see a sheep or a fly blown. With, you know, basically got maggots all around their backside. It's really not very nice. So if you are a shepherd or if you are a cowherd, it's obvious that you have to pick out those flies' eggs to make sure that those eggs do not a hatch and create enormous trouble for those animals. So, but what does flies' eggs, those things which actually get laid in there and create lots and lots of trouble, what does that mean in the Buddha simile? Here, when a thought of sensual desire has arisen, a monk tolerates it. He does not abandon it, remove it, do away with it, and annihilate it. When a thought of ill will has arisen, the monk does not abandon it, remove it, do away with it, and annihilate it. When a thought of cruelty has arisen, a monk tolerates it, does not abandon it, and does not remove it, or do away with it and annihilate it. When evil or unwholesome states have arisen, a monk tolerates them. He does not abandon them, remove them, do away with them, and annihilate them. That is how a monk fails to pick out the fly's eggs. The point is that just a thought of ill will may come up, and by itself that doesn't seem a big problem at all. But the thing is, like a fly's egg, once it's in there, it starts to hatch and to grow, and once it's established, then it creates a lot of trouble. So if you have like a thought of ill will towards your partner, then at first think, it's no small thing. But you'll find it's like a little fly's egg, it starts to grow. And soon, you know, your whole speech is like fly blown. And from little thoughts, we get these moods, and these moods create these actions, which create terrible trouble in our relationships with other people. And even that's the same with ourselves. Little thoughts of ill will or cruelty or sensory desire, it starts with a small thought. And soon, if we're not careful, we have a big problem. So these are the fly's eggs. Be careful that you pick out your fly's eggs. Otherwise, you may get into these terrible moods of enormous lust or enormous ill will or even cruelty. Sometimes you wonder why, how some people can be so cruel, so merciless sometimes. We think, I could never be like that. But as many people know from psychology, given the right situations, if you are heedless, you don't pick out those fly's eggs, you too can do some things you are ashamed of afterwards. How on earth did I let myself do that? And the point is, you didn't stop it while you had the chance. You pick out the fly's eggs in the beginning, then there's no problem. But if you let them hatch and breed in there, it's a huge problem. So you nip it in the bud. Any questions about that one? Picking out the fly's eggs. Okay, next one. How does a monk fail to dress wounds? That's obvious that sometimes the cows may have a scratch or a wound, step on a thorn or something. What does it mean for the Buddha here? Here, on seeing a form with the eye, a monk grasps at its signs and features. Even though when he leaves the eye faculty unguarded, evil unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. They do not practice the way of its restraint. They do not guard the eye faculty. They do not understand the restraint of the eye faculty. On hearing a sound with the ear, or smelling an odor with the tongue, or on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, or even cognizing a mind object with the mind, they grasp at its signs and its features. Even though, when they leave the mind faculty unguarded, evil unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade them. They do not practice a way of restraint. They do not guard the mind faculty. They do not undertake the restraint of the mind faculty. That is how a monk fails to dress the wounds. It's as if these senses are like wounds on the mind, which if you don't look after them, like a wound can get infected. In the same way, the signs and the features, it's like this. Is sometimes you see an object. Say if you're a boy, you see a girl. And what does a boy look for when he sees a girl? Straight away, the boy goes for the most beautiful part. The one which incites the lust. So if they like the hair, they go for the hair. If they go for the shape, they go for the shape. Whatever it is. And they go straight for that. How many of you boys, when you see a beautiful girl, go and look at her feet? None of you. Why is that? Because feet are not known for being completely beautiful. They're just feet, that's all. So why is it we go for some other part of the person? Or if a girl's looking at a boy, what do you look at? If you really want to sort of excite yourself, you look for that part which incites sort of desire. Which, you know, if you're sort of going out looking for a partner, maybe there may be some point to that. But if you're already married, if you've already got a partner, you've got to be careful. Because if you left your eye faculty unguarded, soon you're in love. Oh, I know you're my wife, but I found this wonderful girl. Oh, she's so nice. She's my soulmate. And of course, it's just like a madness form from keeping the eye faculty unguarded and the other faculties unguarded. And we all know, I don't know if the movies have changed since I used to watch them, but in my day it was always boy meets girl and something happens on the way. And it's all about sort of unrequited love or sort of affairs outside of marriage. That's what movies are all about. So apparently even Star Wars is, I was reading about that today, Star Wars is always about like boy meets girl or something. But then they have like a galactic war or something in the way. But that galactic war is just, just the intermission between boy meets girl and then boy finally finds girl. So anyway, this is what happens. And it's also not just the lust, the desire, but sometimes the ill will as well, the ugliness. Because sometimes if one is in a bad mood, one just looks for that person's defects, something which will feed one's ill will. Just, what are you looking at me that way for? You're just looking for something. And that what the good parts of what they're looking at, or what are you saying that for? Stop looking at me like that. Whatever it is, you're just trying to find something. You're selecting the features and characteristics which are going to feed your ill will. And it's beautiful here when they, I always like this in this restraint of the senses, that what is it? That the evil and unwholesome states of covetousness and grief, of grief is like the negativity. It doesn't actually mean grief, it means like bad states of mind. And like wanting and like non-wanting. So they invade the mind. And I like the way they use the word invade the mind, as if they don't belong there. They're not sort of the nature of the mind. But these things of like wanting and aversion, hatred and love, they don't belong to the mind, but they actually get in there. Because you allow the senses to be unguarded, like a wound not being dressed. And therefore it gets infected. And everything gets much, much worse. So you can see like hatred or ill will, sort of grief, the real grief or worry. It is like an infection of the mind. And it's all come because one didn't left the mind unguarded. But it's not just the five senses, you've got the sixth sense there as well, the mind. And the Buddha is saying to guard that too. So if you see like unwholesome, unskillful thoughts coming up, and it may be like the grief, someone, a loved one has died, and you start just catching those features, those characteristics, the negative part of that. Oh, so I was reading in the paper yesterday, oh, the Pope has died. So the case, oh, the Pope has died, why has the Pope died? And then I think it was in Philip Adams in the Australian saying, what are they worried about? If you believe he's a Pope, of all Catholics, he should have gone up to heaven. It should be wonderful. Oh, amazing, the Pope has died. Congratulations, hallelujah. Isn't it wonderful, the Pope has died. He's gone to heaven. But no one feels like that because they just get the characteristics of grief. And he said, so you have to keep your mind guarded as well. Otherwise, the joys, the negative joys of life, or the negative fears of life. Someone just told me, because I know they're an Eagles supporter, the Eagles won this morning apparently, or this afternoon or sometime, and he was just so happy. But probably next week when they lose, he'd go, he'd be so depressed. And that's a good example of keeping the mind unguarded. Because you can only win for so long, and then you've got to lose, that's part of life. So we have to dress the wounds to keep our mind guarded so we don't get blown around by such things as the success and failure of our footy team or the success and failure of our life or whatever else we see and experience. Keep the mind guarded. Yeah, it's just like the wisdom of a cowherd who sees there's a scratch there and sees if he doesn't dress that wound quickly, doesn't guard it, infection will come in. So right, some of you might really sort of like park in front of you. That's a little wound. If you don't like guard your mind, you get, oh, that bastard, they shouldn't do that. Who do you think they are? And straight away your mind is getting infected because you didn't guard your mind. Yeah, awareness has to be action. Awareness with comprehension. It has to be the awareness which in this case resists a movement of the mind which goes into negative states. It's a resisting. It's a stopping. It's a seeing as if you're going on a path which is going to lead in over a precipice or over a waterfall. You see that, the knowledge is that this is a dangerous path. And you stop. The cowherd knows what a wound is and knows that if he doesn't do something about that, then that wound is going to get infected and much worse. And as you all know, if you sort of have a little wound or a scratch, if you clean it up very quickly, there's usually no problem at all. But if you leave it there for even like an hour or two, once the infection gets in there, you're in big trouble. Okay. Now, how does a monk fail to smoke out the sheds? Now, I must admit, I'm not sure what this means when we're talking about cows. Maybe it's because cows have fleas or ticks or something else, and when they sort of go into their sheds at night or in the cold weather or in the rain or something, those ticks or those fleas, they breed in there, and maybe smoking them out gets rid of those. Maybe. Has anyone got any ideas of what that means in herding cows? Yeah, it sounds like that. Sorry? Mosquitoes, yeah. But what does it mean for one who's practicing Dhamma? Here a monk does not teach others in detail the Dhamma as he has learned and mastered it. That is how a monk fails to smoke out the sheds. That's a fascinating little saying. And this is actually, I think, one of the reasons why some of the monks actually point this out, saying that it doesn't matter even if you're a young monk, still you should actually help other people, if at all possible, to teach at least what you know, even if you may not be a great teacher. Because I'm not sure, maybe by smoking out the sheds, maybe just by teaching a little bit of Dhamma, actually that you are maybe creating or rather resisting the smell of unwholesome ideas in the world. Smoking out the negativity of the world, smoking out the lack of kindness in the world, smoking out the ignorance and stupidity of the world by teaching as much as you can. Because the cows, this is where they live, and this world is where the human beings live. If we don't smoke out the little fleas and the insects and the mosquitoes, which continually harass our happiness and well-being, then of course those negative forces will grow and multiply. Maybe I think that's what the Buddha meant here. So it's an obligation of monks to teach, to smoke out the sheds where human beings inhabit. So this is a smoking out of the Buddhist society of Western Australia. Any comments on that one? Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Because here they use it for a monk, but it says anybody who is practicing so that one is capable of growth, increase and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline. So if you want to, it also applies to you, if you want to have growth and increase in this Dhamma discipline, this is what you should do as well. And the thing is here, that this saying here, it doesn't mean you have to be fully enlightened. It's saying actually here, to teach others in detail the Dhamma as you have learned and mastered it. Just to teach what you know. What is beyond you? Obviously you say, well, I haven't got that far yet. You have to be humble and realistic and say, this is as much as I know. But even that much is valuable, it says here. If you don't do that, it says that you won't have growth yourself in the Dhamma. So you have to do this, each one of you. So when you leave here, please get a soapbox on Hay Street Mall and go and smoke out some sheds. I could get into trouble for that. 9. How does a monk not know the watering place? Here, a monk does not go from time to time to those monks who have learned much, who are well versed in the tradition,
who maintain the Dhamma, the discipline, and the codes. And he does not inquire and ask questions of them thus, "How is this, Venerable Sir? What is the meaning of this?" These Venerable Ones do not reveal to him what he has not been revealed, do not clarify what is not clear or remove doubts about the numerous things that give rise to doubt. That is how a monk does not know the watering place. So it's quite clear for a cow, obviously, especially those of you who've been to India, sometimes it gets very, very dry. If you don't know where those watering places are, then obviously those cows are going to get very thirsty and even die. And here the watering places are those teachers who can instruct and who can inspire. So I know that I would hope you all think, and I reckon this is a great watering place in Perth. There's a great watering hole at Gidgee-Gannup. There's a great watering hole down at Serpentine. I don't know what the Gallup government thinks is a water crisis in West Australia. He just doesn't know where the watering holes really are. So these are the watering places. But it's also interesting here that it says you go to those people who are well versed and who maintain the Dhamma and discipline. In other words, those who practice it, who know it and practice it, who are versed in it and maintain it. And to ask questions of them. How is this, Venerable Sir? What is the meaning of this? And anyone who has read these suttas knows that from the very, very beginning, questioning was important. It was encouraged. It was said it was crucial. And Buddhism was always a tradition of questioning. Obviously teaching, but you question afterwards. And I know that some other traditions you weren't even allowed to question. But certainly the Buddhist tradition, you can see from this, that right from the very beginning, you're supposed to, you're expected. If you don't question, they say you're not going to grow in the Dhamma and discipline. It's not a path of blind belief. It's a path of empowerment, of teaching, of conveying the Dhamma through teaching and also question and answer. So do you understand that? You have a question? Thank you, you've understood it. Anyone else? The codes. I think here that they would usually mean that sometimes, this is interesting here, whether this was actually in the original or not, because I think the codes here is called matika. Matika was almost like a mnemonic way of learning like the headings of different dhammas. So example, the Four Noble Truths. What are the Four Noble Truths? You just know them from their titles. Like suffering, the cause of suffering, end of suffering, the way to the end of suffering. But it's much more than that, because those are just like summaries of the four main parts of the Four Noble Truths, or the Eightfold Path, you know, right view, right understanding, and so forth. But that's not the whole thing, that's just the code. That's the matrix. Because matika, I think it is the word here, I'll just check it up on the back from the... I'm pretty sure that that's the meaning... The Pali word. Yeah, matika. You know what matika is in English? That's a Sanskrit word, and it comes in English as matrix. Yes, the movie Matrix of matika. Same. Come from the, matika is the old Pali word, Sanskrit word, and from that we have the English word matrix. We get lots of actually Pali Sanskrit words, because English is an Indo, what's it called? Indo-Aryan language, yeah. That there's many actually British English words that have actually come from the Sanskrit. You know, we've got something like yobana. You know what yob means? Yobana, youth. That's from yobana, a yob. There's lots of words like that, which, you know, when you actually read it in Pali, you don't need to look at the dictionary, you know what that is. And so matika is matrix. So this is actually what it means, like a way of understanding a teaching just by having the headings. Yeah? It's a hard one to say. Probably Sanskrit was the more ancient language, because the Vedas were in Sanskrit. And Pali became an idiom of
Sanskrit. In other words, as you had the perfect language, as people used it in daily life. It's a dialect, that's what I was wording, yeah. But it was, it's not even more like a dialect. It was like a corruption of Sanskrit. Because even today, just as language changes, we tend to slur our words, to shorten them. And by so doing, like a good one is like omnibus. That was actually it's a Latin word, means for everybody. And that was actually the name of the carriages for many people. And that was actually used, I think, in London about 100 years ago, when the first automated vehicles. And of course, you know, omnibus, they used to get the omnibus, say, from Clapham to Tooting Common. And of course, that got shortened to bus. And so that's the origin of the word bus. It's just the ending of an omnibus. So you can see just how language, we shorten things because of convenience. And in the same way that Pali shortened things, it slurred some vowels. Instead of Dhamma, it came Dhamma. It's easier to say. Instead of Kashyapa, you get Kasapa. So it became like a slurring of the language, making it easier. And so Pali was like a corrupt form of Sanskrit. But then later on, the reason why it's not such a simple historical progression was later on there was like a reform movement to take especially the Buddhist scriptures back into pure Sanskrit, as if it was like keeping like the Mass and Christianity in Latin. And so there was a movement, especially in Mahayana, to actually to put everything back into Sanskrit. And so there was the Sanskritization of the texts. So Sanskrit was a very old language, and then sort of had something like Pali, which became famous because the Buddhist Theravada texts were put in Pali. Then later texts were put back into Sanskrit again. So you got like the old Sanskrit, but you got the medieval Sanskrit as well, a reworking of it. In Pali, yes. The Buddhist. Sanskrit, yes. No, but Sanskrit and Pali back to English. Which is what we've got here, right in front of you. No, that doesn't make any sense at all. Because I think once it went to Sanskrit, it wouldn't go back to Pali. Okay, that's the knowing the watering places. I know that many Australians think the watering places means the pubs, and they're a person who doesn't know watering places. No, number. Is there any other questions about that one? Yeah. Yeah. Ah, to a certain extent, it's important to give it a place in the world culture to say this is Buddhist teachings, this is Christian teachings, this is Muslim teachings, this is atheist teachings, because sometimes that gives it a way that they can relate it to other people's teachings. So it's just giving the children knowledge, but give them a fair amount of knowledge, not sort of just pounding on one teaching to the exclusion of others. So there's no reason why, you know, if you say, if you kick a football between these goalposts, you call that footy. You know, if you got a bat and a ball, you call it cricket. So it's just giving it a name so the kids can make sense of the world. So these particular types of teachings are called Buddhism. Other teachings are called Christianity. So we don't need to sort of be afraid of giving it a descriptive name. It's when we say, Buddhism is the only religion, this is the only truth, everything else is wrong. That's when we create troubles in the world. Like we say, cricket is the only sport. Nah, footy's a mug's game. Or whatever like that. You don't say things like that. So, is that the question you were answering? Okay. Yeah, you can do that, yeah. But I think it's good to actually, no need to shilly shally and just say this is Buddhist teachings or this is Christian teachings. Yeah, okay. Sometimes, but in like a mother with the kids, think there should be a real openness there. But also, you see here that the kids have to ask questions. And sometimes it's very hard for mother and a father, because always asking questions, but the kids should be encouraged to ask questions. Because that's actually where they learn. You could say, oh, there's enough questions for now, but please ask them later on. That's right, yes, you don't know the answer. You haven't got enough water in your tap, go to another watering place. Okay. So, and how does a bhikkhu not know, a monk not know, what it is to have drunk? This is actually gone to the watering places. Now, have you drunk when you've been here or not? What does it mean to have drunk? Because people, the cows, could have gone to the watering places, but, you know, have they really drunk? Have they made use of the water yet? Here, when the Dhamma and discipline is proclaimed by the Tathagata, is being taught, a monk does not gain inspiration in the meaning, does not gain inspiration in the Dhamma, and does not gain gladness connected with the Dhamma. That is how a monk does not know what it is to have drunk. So the point of actually these teachings is not just to give you knowledge, but also to give you inspiration. You get inspired and you get gladness. And this is another powerful point here, that if the Dhamma, the truth, the teachings have really been given and you've drunk those teachings, you've understood them, the sign of that, you get inspired and glad. Wow, this is amazing, this is wonderful. And inspiration is an important part of the path, as is gladness. Those of you who have listened to the Dhamma a lot will know that it's from inspiration and gladness you get the power to meditate and get into deep states of meditation. And those of you who were in India recently, you find some of these places were so inspiring. You cried. You got gladness. You drank at those places. So when you go to the watering hole, you don't just look at the water, that's nice, you drink it. And you know that you've drunk, because you get gladness and inspiration. You get joy. Just like when I've had my cup of tea. I know when I've had my cup of tea, because I get inspiration in the caffeine. I get gladness for the taste. I know what it is to have drunk. So when you come to a Dhamma talk, you know, you've drunk it if you get inspired. Yeah, that's true. I would say that too, yeah. If you haven't got the happiness and gladness when you start meditating, you better get that happiness and gladness coming up soon. Otherwise, you're going to waste your time. Because when you get negativity, you find your negativity builds up and you just get into black states. And the mind can never really get into deep meditation that way. So it's good to get some inspiration going up and happiness coming up. That's one of those... Sorry? Yeah, well, within reason. And I'd say, okay, let's get a glass of whiskey before I meditate. Yeah, I feel really happy now. Let's take a sort of a joint and get some uppers. That's not the right way of doing it. But you know, it's very easy actually when you know there's little skillful ways of getting yourself happy and just start meditating. Like that little technique which I was teaching recently of when you close your eyes and you imagine, remember the most peaceful, beautiful experience you've had in your life so far. You recall it. And you build up the picture. All this time and the place, the things which are around you, the weather, the temperature. And soon you're right back there. And then you've got that peace, you've got that inspiration. Now let that go. But stay with the peace and the inspiration. Now you're on the way to meditate. The mind is like, sees that peace and goes in that direction. So you have to start off with some peace and happiness. If you start off with, another hour of meditation, how many minutes to go? Of course, you never get anywhere that way. Yeah, go on. No, but you can actually start getting a little bit of gladness when you start, this is time for myself. This is time I don't have to do anything. I don't have to achieve anything.
throughout my whole day, people are asking me to do things. I've got to go and get the bus. I've got to go and get into the car. I've got to clean this. Telephone's ringing. I've got this letter to write, that job to do. So that's another way. Just meditation. You don't have to do anything. You've got nothing to achieve. This is time for me to do nothing. That gives you a bit of gladness. So it's true, you look for gladness, but you've got to put a seed of gladness before you get more gladness. It's like, you know, you put sort of, you put a dollar in the slot machine, and then you might get a few more dollars out. If you don't put any dollars in, you get no dollars out. I don't know if that's a very good simile, is it? Okay. Is there another question somewhere, yeah? I think the doing the meditation is part of the inspiration. You get inspired and think, wow, this is possible. It can be done. I can understand this. This makes sense. Yeah, let's give it a try. So the inspiration gives you the motivation. And it also gives you the energy to go forward. Yeah? Oh. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because our inspiration, you know, when people are really motivated, when they've got a cause, it's amazing how much energy you can put into that cause. And sometimes it doesn't have to be even spiritual. Some people get inspired by the latest technology. But they really can work so hard on that computer, hour after hour after hour. Where's our president gone? He was on there all day. The thing's still on there. Sometimes when you get inspired and doing something, you can really go for long periods of time. Source of energy. And how does a monk not know the road? This is very quite obvious. You know, driving cattle, you have to know the road to go from the water holes or to the places where there's pasture. And the road is a very obvious one. In this simile, is the Eightfold Path. Here a monk does not understand the Noble Eightfold Path as it actually is. That is how a monk does not know the road. So just like when you come here, you have to know the road to get here. Unfortunately, some people think they know shortcuts. And when you try going a shortcut, you always end up either getting lost or wasting a lot of time. So sometimes people try to make shortcuts on the Eightfold Path. Try and make it a Sevenfold Path or a Sixfold Path or a 5-4-3-2. I got this special quick path, only one practice. Or one full path. Say, yeah, I'll go for that one. But usually you find up, you get lost. You waste a lot of time. You go down the wrong way, down one-way streets, and that's called not knowing the path as it actually is. So the Noble Eightfold Path, the Buddha taught that all the teachers for the last 2,500 years have taught the Eightfold Path. That's the path, very clear. So don't try and think, oh, I'm going to find a shortcut. Don't try and reinvent the wheel. It's been done many, many, many times. You think, oh, yeah, now I can do it the quick way. Sometimes people get lost. They waste a lot of time trying to find the quick way. This is the quick way. So, you have to know the road so your cows do not get lost. And how is a monk unskilled in pastures? Here, a monk does not understand the four foundations of mindfulness as they actually are. That is how a monk is unskilled in pastures. This is actually alludes to another story, the simile of the quail. And that particular story is a simile which the Buddha gave elsewhere. Little quail, little bird, like a little pigeon. And he was wandering sort of outside where he usually lives. And a hawk saw him on the sort of the meadow, swooped down and picked him up and was about to sort of eat him. And the little quail said, oh, I'm just so unlucky. You caught me in that little time I was outside of my pasture. If you were, I was in my own pasture, you'd never be able to catch me. And the hawk, being very proud, said, little quail, I can catch you anywhere. He said, no, you can't. You only catch me when I'm out of my usual home. He said, what is your usual home? And that field down there, that ploughed field. And the hawk said, I can catch you anywhere. He said, no, you can't. Yes, I can. No, you can't. So they had a bet, like a wager. So the hawk put the little quail down in the ploughed field and said, okay, you know, count to 10, I'm coming for you.
or something like that. I do adapt these stories. That's not what you read in the suttas. And so the hawk went up in the air, and the quail stood on a clod of earth and said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, come! And the quail dived for the hawk dived at the quail, went straight down for him. And just at the last minute, the quail just went under a clod of earth. And the hawk, going so fast, couldn't stop, and hit the clod of earth, and smashed up his body and died. So the quail survived. It was true. If the quail stayed at his usual pasture, where it was nice and safe, the hawk could never get him. And the Buddha said, monks, if you keep within the four foundations of mindfulness, nothing bad will ever happen to you. You will always be safe from greed, hate, and delusion. And those four foundations of mindfulness, or four focus of mindfulness, is always focusing on the body, knowing it as impermanent, not me, not mine, not a self. On Vedana, just to know these are just feelings of happiness and pain, that's all they are, they're not mine. The things which come and go. Knowing the mind is just mind. Knowing the objects of the mind, that's all they are, they just come and go. So whatever happiness, sadness, it just is going. Now you're happy, now you're sad. Now it's hot, now it's cold. It's just a flux of life. So if you stay with that recollection, that understanding, the Buddha said, you know the pastures and you'll always be safe. In the same way the cowherd knows the pastures where the cows are safe, where they can actually graze, good grass, no dangers from, say, tigers. They're not grazing in somebody else's field where the owner will get fined or imprisoned because they pinch somebody else's grass. You're skilled in the pastures. So he said the pastures, the one practicing the path, is the four focuses of mindfulness. Make sense? Any questions? Okay, the next one. Now this is one of my favorite ones. How does a monk milk dry? Here, when faithful householders invite a monk to take as much as he likes of robes, arms, food, resting places, medicinal requisites, the monk does not know moderation in accepting. That's how he milks dry. So, I say we're going to have an appeal. We're collecting money for our retreat center, and I milk you all dry. And of course, that's not for getting anywhere. And on the reverse side, you see a good monk and you say, can you give me another talk? Can you go into this place? Can you come to that place? Can you come to my house? And you always ask questions all day, all night. That's how you milk the monks and the nuns dry. It goes both ways. If you do that, you find that sort of if you milk the cows dry, they die or they just run away, go elsewhere. So it goes both ways. And it's also your friends and relations and your loved ones. Don't milk each other dry. You can take a little bit, but no moderation. And how does... Oh, any questions on that one? How does a monk show no extra veneration to those elder monks of long standing who have long gone forth, the fathers and leaders of the Sangha? Here a monk does not maintain bodily acts of loving kindness both openly and privately towards those elder monks. He does not maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them both openly and privately. He does not maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them both openly and privately. That is how a monk shows no extra veneration to those elder monks of long standing who have long gone forth, the fathers and leaders of the Sangha. So this is actually even in the cows. The good cow herd, even like cows, have their little bit of hierarchy, their little bit of leaders, and so it's good that the cow herd actually shows a little bit of extra veneration, to the leaders, to the elders, both in wisdom and in position in the community. And it's something important. Hierarchy is a part of our life, it's a part of all cultures. And we should understand that and give a little bit of extra attention to the elders in our community. To the elderly people, to those in senior positions, whatever. If you do that, obviously the cows have got a nice social structure which is in harmony. And so this is what we should do as even children, to actually to respect our parents. And that's actually knowing the little hierarchy. It gives them a bit of extra attention. How do we do that? It's not bowing and scraping. How we do it according to Buddhism is maintaining bodily acts, verbal acts, and also mental acts of loving kindness. Not just in their presence, but even in private as well. And that's how we show veneration. Not just by, you know, obsequious deeds in front of everybody, but speech and also thoughts, even in private. Yeah. Yeah, because I know that anyone who is in such a position of politics in a Western country gets so much criticism. And usually when I'm with them, I want to balance that with praise. To actually not to suck up to them, but just to say to them, well, look, you know, okay, you make mistakes, but that's what other people always tell you. But look, you know, you're sort of a reasonably honest person. You know, just you're a representative of our society and usually a pretty upright representative as far as the average is concerned. You're not perfect, you make mistakes, you've got your selfishness and your bit of greed and ill will sometimes, but you're a pretty good person. Pretty upright. I mean, most of our politicians, despite what we sometimes think, you know, are reasonable people. They're upright, they're trying to do the right thing, according to their view, in Australia. And so as such, you want to encourage that goodness in them. Because you know what I've taught before, basic psychology, if you keep on pointing out people's faults, they become those faults. That's what they show you more and more. If you encourage their goodness, they become better people. So that's why I want to encourage them. That's why acts of kindness, acts of speech, a speech of kindness and thoughts of kindness towards our leaders, I think, are very important. We literally wish them well, realizing they have some terrible decisions to sometimes make. So we wish them well in those decisions, rather than wishing them ill will. I think dictators can sometimes feed on ill will. Okay. So, when a monk possesses these 11 qualities, they are incapable of growth. They haven't got any of these ideas. They're incapable of growth, increase and fulfillment in the Dhamma and discipline. And now it's just a usual teaching technique, having said it once, to repeat it, to make sure the message gets across. So I'll just read this through quickly because it's repeating, only this time the opposite. This is not what a bhikkhu hasn't got, which leads to him his incapability of growth. Now these are the 11 qualities they have got, which lead to their growth. Monks, when a cowherd possesses 11 factors, he is capable of keeping and rearing a herd of cattle. What 11? Here a cowherd has knowledge of form, they are skilled in characteristics, they pick out flies' eggs. They dress wounds, they smoke out the sheds, they know the watering place, they know what it is to have drunk. They know the road, they are skilled in pastures, they do not milk dry, and they show extra veneration to those bulls who are fathers and leaders of the herd. When a cowherd possesses his 11 factors, they are capable of keeping and rearing a herd of cattle. So too, monks, when a monk possesses these 11 qualities, they are capable of growth, increase and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline. What 11? Here a monk has knowledge of form, they are skilled in characteristics, they pick out flies' eggs, they dress wounds, they smoke out the sheds, they know the watering place, they know what it is to have drunk, they know the road, they are skilled in pastures, they do not milk dry, and they show extra veneration to those elder monks of long standing who have long since gone forth, the fathers and leaders of the Sangha. And how does a monk have knowledge of form? Again, here a monk understands that it actually is thus, all material form of whatever kind consists of the four great elements, and the material form derived from those great elements. That is how a monk has the knowledge of material things. How is a monk skilled in characteristics? Here a monk understands as it actually is thus. A fool is characterized by his actions. A wise man is characterized by their actions. That is how a monk is skilled in characteristics. How does a monk pick out flies' eggs? Here when the thoughts of sensual desire has arisen, the monk does not tolerate them. They abandon it, remove it, does away with it, annihilates it. When the thought of ill will has arisen, the thought of cruelty has arisen, when even unwholesome states have arisen, a monk does not tolerate them. They abandon them, remove them, do away with them, and annihilate them. That is how they pick out the fly's eggs. How does a monk dress wounds? Here, on seeing a form with the eye, the bhikkhu does not grasp at its signs and features, since if he left the eye faculty unguarded, even unwholesome states of covetousness and bad mind might invade them. They practice a way of its restraint. They guard the eye faculty. They undertake the restraint of the eye faculty. Similarly, on hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odour with the nose, on tasting a flavour with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind, the monk does not grasp at its signs and features, since if they left the mind faculty unguarded, evil unwholesome states of covetousness and ill will might invade them. They practice a way of restraint. They guard the mind faculty, they undertake the restraint of the mind faculty. That is how a monk dresses the wounds. And how does a monk smoke out the shed? Here a monk teaches others in detail the Dhamma, as he has learned and mastered it. That is how someone smokes out the sheds. And how does someone know the watering places? Here a monk goes from time to time to such monks who have learned much, who are well versed in the tradition, who maintain the Dhamma, the discipline, and the codes. And they inquire and ask questions of them thus, "How is this, Venerable Sir? What is the meaning of that?" And those Venerable Ones reveal to him what has not been revealed. They clarify what was not clear and remove the doubts about the numerous things that give rise to doubt. That is how a monk knows a watering place. And how does a monk know what is to have drunk? Here, when the Dhamma discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata, the Buddha, is being taught, a monk gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. That is how a monk knows what it is to have drunk. And how does a monk know the road? Here a monk understands the Noble Eightfold Path as it actually is. That is how a monk understands the road. How is a monk skilled in pastures? Here a monk understands the four foundations of mindfulness as they actually are. That is how the monk is skilled in pastures. And how does a monk not milk dry? Here, when faithful householders invite a monk to take as much as they like of robes, arms, food, resting places, and medicinal requisites, the monk knows moderation in accepting. That is how a monk does not milk dry. And how does a monk show extra veneration to those elder monks of long standing who have long gone forth, the fathers and leaders of the Sangha? Here a monk maintains bodily acts of loving kindness, both openly and privately, towards those elders. They maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. And they maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. That is how a monk shows extra veneration to those elder monks of long standing, who have long gone forth, the fathers and leaders of the Sangha. When a monk possesses 11 qualities, they are capable of growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma discipline. That is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. That's the first Kau Sutta. Yes. Briefly, my goodness, that's a whole series of talks, not one talk. The four focuses of mindfulness. I call them focuses. What you put your mindfulness on. First of all, you have to arouse mindfulness, first of all. You have to have this strong mindfulness. And mindfulness is not just seeing, but it's also recollecting as well. So, in other words, you practice just the knowing, just what this form is, what body is, what it truly is. What is this thing, your frame you call John? And you dissect it, analyze it to know it, until you can actually see that this is just body, that's all. It's not me, it's not an Australian, not a male. It's just body, that's all. And you do the same with Vedana, with these feelings of pleasure, pain, beauty, ugliness, tasty or just terrible taste. It's just, that's all it is, just last little moment. The Buddha said it's like a drop of rain on a puddle. Little plop and it's all gone. That's Vedana, just a momentary. Now it's pleasurable, now it's painful. So you know it's in flux. There's no way you can get constant happiness. No way there'll be constant pain. So you understand the nature of these things. And you understand the nature of the mind. That which knows, the knower, the mind, the citta. You know exactly what it really is. When you know what it really is, you know it's just mind. That's all, just a process. Not me, not mine. This is not who I am. just a process. And then you notice the mental objects. And especially in that one, they say that includes all the other khandhas, such as will. You know that what the knower is, what the doer is, it's just a process, that's all. So when you know these things, you know that nothing belongs to you. Therefore you don't worry about anything. You don't worry about anything. Nothing can challenge you in the world. You're at peace. That's in brief what is usually takes a long time to explain. Yes. Mindfulness is established when the five hindrances are put away. Remember the five hindrances. The desire is what sort of stops you looking at what's happening now, to look what's over there. It's, you know, it's 4:15, I'm thirsty, I want that cup of tea. So I'm not listening to actually what's happening, I'm just thinking, wish Ajahn would hurry up, wish Ajahn would happy up, I want that cup of tea. When there's longing, you're not here, you're the object of your longing. That's the first hindrance. The second hindrance is ill will. It's, I don't want to be here, this is terrible, why am I here? Again, you're not really here, you just want to get away. You refuse to look at the moment when you have ill will. Sloth and torpor. You can never see clearly then. And restlessness. You're just going all over the place. You can't see anything. It's just all over. You never stay with anything long enough to see it. And doubt. You're always interfering with the moment by questioning too much. It's the five hindrances which stop mindfulness. That's why, as a meditator, that's our task, to abandon those hindrances which stop mindfulness. And once those hindrances are overcome, then mindfulness is strong. Strong enough, still enough, equanimous enough, with no desire and ill will, to be able to see clearly. Make sense? It's just by patience, waiting to the end. I was going to explain that in a minute. You interfered. If you'd have waited, you'd have got the answer. So you wait. You gather the data. And only when you've got enough data, then you make your conclusion. This is just the tendency of the human being to want to know now, quick, give it to me now. You... Doubt, yeah, this is also, doubt is almost like a part of restlessness. This is actually where you keep asking questions too often. You wait for a while. What is this? Shh, we're telling you. Yes. Yeah, sure.
The first eight, when you got the first grade entrance, I thought the point it was making was that when you're teaching the Dharma to others, you must be careful to teach it as you learn to master it. I thought there was an understanding in Buddhism that you didn't teach the Dharma unless people express an interest or asked.
That's true also, but I think there's plenty of people asking, but some people say, no, I don't want to do this. No, it's just, I don't think I'm good enough. I'm not old enough. I don't know enough to teach. You see what happens. There's never enough teachers to go around any place. So this is why I think it's saying that, no, this is one sutta where it says you've got an obligation to teach. Yeah.
Because I have this feeling that I shouldn't be telling them something that they haven't expressed interest in learning. But it's a bit like the old Christian idea of casting pearls before swine. I'm not calling my own Christian.
Yeah.
But the idea of a soapbox, you know, that's if people are not really listening, should one be teaching?
Correct. No, if they're not really listening. But then sometimes that people actually, they want to listen. But, you know, the thing, it's not the problem of the people and the receivers. I think it's the person giving out the teachings are not willing to teach. Or they think, you know, they're too lazy to teach. Or they don't think they're up to teaching. I think here the Buddha's saying, no, just do a little bit of teaching. But teach what you know, not more than that. Obviously don't impress a person by just knocking on the door and telling them the good news about the Buddha and the Buddhist society. It's not a good thing to do. But I mean, between those extremes, there's when somebody is interested, yeah. Or if, you know, say John gives you a call and say, look, there's a school nearby, they'd like to, you know, they ask me, can we go and give a talk on Buddhism? Don't say, oh, no, I don't think I know enough about Buddhism to be able to teach, yeah. And teach what you know. Barren ground, yeah. But see, the Israelis know, it's amazing what we can do with barren ground, with a bit of sort of hard work. You can grow a garden in a desert, make a forest in the granite. Yeah, well, just get out a duster. Okay, so we're now going to go to the second sutta, which is, again, it's a short one because we are going a little bit over time. This is a shorter discourse on the cowherd, thank goodness, because we've only got 10 minutes. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, a blessed one was living in the Wajian country at Ukachela on the banks of the river Ganges. So that is in the southern part of the Wajin country. For those of you who were in India recently, when Patna is just the northern part of the Magadhan kingdom, over the river was the Wajin kingdom. So it's just the other side from Patna. Yeah, somewhere along the northern bank. Now it's important here because it's on the bank of the Ganges. Monks, there was once a foolish Magadhan cowherd from the southern side of the river, who in the last month of the rainy season, this is the rivers will be pretty full at that time, in the autumn, without examining the near shore or the further shore of the river Ganges, drove his cattle across to the other shore in the Vaidyan country, that's, you know, in the, where the Wajians were, at a place that had no ford. Then the cattle bunched together in midstream in the river Ganges, and they met with calamity and disaster. Why was that? Because that foolish Magadhan cowherd, in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn, without examining the near shore, the further shore of the river Ganges, drove his cattle across to the other shore in the Wajian country at a place that had no ford. Obviously, the Buddha would have never taught this sutta if he was in the Magadhan country, south of the Ganges. Because that would be, you know, putting down, making like the Magadhans appear stupid. Remember, these were two kingdoms against each other, or a kingdom and a democracy. It would be like if you're in Australia, you'd call the New Zealanders stupid. If you're New Zealander, you call the Australians stupid. So, you know, it was very sensitive to what was going on there in the time. So in the Wajin country, it was okay to call the Magadhan the stupid cowherd. So too, monks, as for those recluses and Brahmins, these are the monastic communities, who are unskilled in this world and the other world, unskilled in Mara's realm and what's outside of Mara's realm, unskilled in the realm of death and what is outside the realm of death, it will lead to the harm and suffering for a long time of those who think they should listen to them and place faith in them. That's a powerful statement there. So if you don't know this world and the other world, what's beyond the world, this is the world of the five senses. And what's beyond the realm of the five senses? They call this realm of the five senses karma loka. It literally means the world, the loka, or the five senses. Basically, if you don't know jhanas, if you don't know what is Mara's realm and outside Mara's realm, this is not something different. It's the same thing said a different way. It says in many suttas, when you get into a jhana, you're beyond Mara's realm. You're outside his influence. Again, it means jhanas. And unskilled in the realm of death and what is outside the realm of death. That's the insight practices, the enlightenment factors. stages where you're beyond death. Now, on the opposite, monks, there was once a wise Magadan cowherd, who in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn, after examining the near shore and the further shore of the River Ganges, drove his cattle across to the other shore, in the Wadian country, at a place that had a ford. He made the bulls, the fathers and leaders of the herd, enter first, and they breasted the stream of the Ganges and got safely across to the other shore. He made the strong cattle and the cattle to be tamed enter next, and they too breasted the stream of the Ganges and got safely across the further shore. Then he made the heifers and young oxen enter next, and they too breasted the stream of the Ganges and got safely across the further shore. He made the calves and the feeble cattle enter next, and they too breasted the stream of the Ganges and got safely across the further shore. And at that time there was a tender calf just born, and being urged on by its mother's lowing, moo, moo, it too, I don't know if that was a cow, lowing, is that a good cow sound? I do try my best. It too breasted the stream of the Ganges and got safely across the further shore. Why was that? Because that wise Magadan cowherd in the last month of the rainy season, in autumn, after examining the near shore and the further shore, he knew the way across, he knew the path, drove his cattle across to the other shore in the Wadian country at a place that had a ford. So too, monks, as to those recluses and Brahmins who are skilled in this world and the other world, skilled in Mara's realm, what is outside Mara's realm, skilled in the realm of death, what is outside the realm of death, it will lead to the welfare and happiness for a long time of those who think they should listen to them and place faith in them. These are like the wise cowherds who know the way across. Bhikkhus, just as the bulls, the fathers and leaders of the herd, breasted the stream of the Ganges and got safely across to the further shore, so too those monks who are arahats, with the taints, these outflowings of the mind, destroyed, who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and are completely liberated through final knowledge. By breasting Mara's short stream, they have got safely across to the other shore. Just as the strong cattle and the cattle to be tamed breasted the stream of the Ganges and got safely across the further shore, so too those monks who, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, will reappear spontaneously in their pure abodes and there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. These are the non-returners. By breasting Mara's stream, they will get safely across to the further shore. Just as the heifers and young oxen breasted the stream of the Ganges and got safely across to the further shore, so too those monks who, with the destruction of the three fetters and with the attenuation of lust, hate and delusion, are once returners, returning only once to this world to make an end of suffering. These are Sakadagami, once returners. By breasting Mara's stream, they too will get safely across to the further shore. Just as the calves and the feeble cattle breasted the stream of the Ganges and got safely across to the further shore, so to those monks who, with the destruction of the three fetters, are stream enterers, no longer subject to perdition, bound for deliverance, headed for enlightenment, Sotapannas, by breasting Mara's stream, they too will get safely across to the further shore. And just as that tender calf born just that day, being urged on by its mother's lowing, moo, moo, also breasted the stream of the Ganges and got safely across the further shore, so too those monks who are Dhamma followers and faith followers, these are on the path of being a stream winner. By breasting Mara's stream, they too will get safely across to the farther shore, further shore. Monks, I am skilled in this world and the other world, skilled in Mara's realm, what is outside Mara's realm, skilled in the realm of death and what is outside the realm of death. It will lead to the wealth and happiness for a long time of those who think they should listen to me and place faith in me. That is what the Buddha said. When the Sublime One said that, he said further, both this world and the world beyond are well described by the one who knows. And what is still in Mara's reach and what is out of reach of death, knowing directly all the world, the enlightened one who understands, open the door to the deathless state by which Nibbana may be safely reached. For Mara's stream is breasted now, its currents blocked, its reeds removed. Rejoice then, monks, mightily, and set your hearts where safety lies. So, this is like just taking cows across the stream. So, we're all going across the stream. Which particular type of cow are you? It's Sometimes it's extreme winners. That's only the calves and the feeble cattle. Maybe I'm not even up to that yet, you may think. But you may be just a tender calf just born, being urged on by its mother's lowing. I'm not going to try that again. These are the Dhamma followers and the faith followers. Those ones, if they're Dhamma followers, they've got enough knowledge of the Dhamma. They've got faith as well, but enough knowledge that they can't give this up. They've got a taste. And they know what's, you know, the path they've got to live, the lead. It's only a matter of time. Just that little insight is enough. It's like the Buddha just blowing, bringing you across. And the faith followers are the same. Maybe the knowledge may be not so great, but you've got this confidence. This sounds so good. It feels so good. It feels right. That too is enough to bring one across. Just as a mother's lowing. You know that mother must be right. So those are how the cows breasted the stream at the ford. They always give that simile in Buddhism. Of like the whole path is like going from a dangerous shore, going to the other shore where it's nice and safe. It always was a metaphor, which was not just in Buddhism, which also in Jainism as well, because they gave the name to the leaders of the Jains like ford makers. So it was always a metaphor, which was very common at that time, because you can see in India, those have been there, those rivers, they were big. Especially in the rainy season, now maybe like a mile across. So it was hard to cross them. You can imagine just that metaphor was so strong in that country at that time. Getting from one place to another place. Maybe the king of the country was after you. For some reason, they were always after you for something or other. And, you know, you had to escape. Go from the place where there was danger over the river to safety. That's why that sometimes they used to call the Eightfold Path like the simile of the raft. The way to get from the dangerous shore, from this shore, over to the far shore. And the dangers were not the king so much as old age, sickness and death. The suffering of life. Getting across to the far shore where it's safe. So as an example of like the metaphors which the Buddha would use in those days. Little ways of describing things from the ordinary experience of his environment. But also some very deep things there as well. Some interesting statements. Any other questions before we finish off? Yes. Now what's this one? Paragraph 3. Oh yeah, okay. This is somebody who doesn't know what they're talking about. So if you follow someone who's not talking, don't know what they're talking about, say they don't know what jhana is, they never experienced a jhana. And they say that jhanas aren't necessary. You can do it another way. What do they know? They don't even know what they're talking about, literally. Or they haven't sort of really practiced very much. And they give all these ideas of what enlightenment is. They don't even know what enlightenment is. And if they don't know what where the fords are, how to get across, then they might take a person across in a place where there's no ford. Just like those cattle in the middle of a stream, they can't go to the other side, they can't go back again. They eventually, because they follow their leader, they all go into the middle of the stream, all get washed away. That comes from your harm, what does it say? Harm and suffering for a long time. Yeah, paragraph 11. Where the Buddha says he was skilled in this world and the other world. He knew what he was talking about. So that's why he could lead people across. He knew the fords. And he knew actually how to take people across. It's interesting here that I never brought out, why do you need the big animals across first of all? Because when you take the big, they're capable of going across. And they give inspiration. It can be done. And sometimes, you know, very often it's like just belief. If you think, oh, I'm going to get swept away. If you lose your nerve, then you do get swept away. But if you have confidence, so you take the arahats across first of all, and you see these great beings fully enlightened, you think, wow, they can do it. And then the anagamis, they're very impressive. They haven't got across, but they're close enough. Wow, they're almost across, I can do it as well. So you can see, you follow the great examples. That's why the smart fellow leads the big cows across first to bolt the strong ones. And then even the very weak ones, the little calves born this very day. Because they've got the mother on the other side, the person you really trust, from faith or through a little bit of knowledge. And they call you, come, come, that's enough. Even though you really shouldn't get across as a little calf, you've got enough faith. And you keep on swimming and off you go. The cow knows what it is. That's right, yes. So this is the simile of the smart cows, the ones at the front. So, thanks. You got a question? Yeah. I just like of life and death. So this is where the Mara has control. Remember, this is another thing about Mara. I made a lot of in the last meditation retreat. Mara is the head of the realm called the Parinimitta Vasavati realm. This is the realm of those who wield power, control over others' creations. In other words, the control freak in chief. The one who controls. So you get beyond control. No more controlling or doing. When is doing, there's death. When is letting go, there's no death. Yes. Sorry? Oh, the cow herder over there is like the Buddha in that one. But it goes to any other teacher. Ones who brings you across. So, thank you all you lovely cows today. I could resist that, sorry. Now we'll please move the next the sutta class, it's because the next Sunday is Vaisak, and the one after that is the 29th. It's still not the first, so the next sutta class will be 3 weeks from today. No, 3 weeks? 4 weeks. Hang on. Because it's the second and fourth. It must be 3 weeks. No, 36. Hang on. Okay, yeah. Hang on, how come we're doing it today? What day is it today? I don't know. 8th of May, yeah. 8th of May is the next time. Don't know yet. Probably not. We'll do one maybe the week afterwards. The next one is the 8th of May. Mother's Day. Bring your mother along. So she too can bless the stream. Your Mother's Day gift. Surprise, Mother, I'm going to take you to the Buddhist Society. So has anyone got any suggestions for the next sutta class?
What about something on these lines with... Because I've kind of been coming up a lot lately. It's called grief and covetousness for the world. You know, people are concerned about like a tsunami, and even now with the people that have been caught for drugs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I've got John is usually a great resource for suggesting the sutras. What have you got? Exposition of truths. Okay, that's a good one. Satya Vibhanga. It's about the Four Noble Truths. In detail. Like that one? Okay. So 141, the exposition of the truth. For your mother, please bring all your mothers along next time. Okay, you can now pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha because the kids' class is finished and the kids are all out there waiting for their parents.
Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sanghang Namami